This is Rocky Mountain Voices. You're listening to the vSpring V100 show, powered by PodTech.
To be the CEO and drive the business, you have to know how to sell all day long. Everything is about sales.
Welcome to the V100 show. My name is Dennis Wood. The V100 is a group of community nominated and peer selected entrepreneurs who have been voted most likely to experience successful venture returns in the next 5 to 7 years. And today I'm here with Amy Lewis, who is CEO of
MetaConnect Global.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for coming here today.
No problem.
Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
My name's Amy Reese Lewis. I am 35-year-old single mother of two kids that are 10 and 13, and I'm the CEO of a company called MetaConnect Global. Background, how far back do you want me to go?
How far back do you want to go?
I went to BYU, attended Brigham Young University in business, and after that went on to start a company kind of out of necessity. Just, you know, I was married at the time with two kids and wanted to be home with them, so I started a business to stay home, and it took off, and within 3 months was definitely out of the home. And
what was that business?
It was an actual medical software company that I started. I started my first business as a reseller of a Fortune 50's medical software, and then went on to raise about $14 million in venture capital and develop my own internet-based software, and never intended to go into business, but just kind of ended up there and have stayed there ever since. So
that's great. That's great. You have a great background, Amy. Just spend a little bit more time on how did you come up with the idea of this software company that you had started?
Originally, I had moved all over the country. My dad was in the FBI, and we moved around a lot. So I was finished with high school at a pretty young age, had jumped ahead of grade and was, you know, kind of done early, but didn't want to give up the social interaction. So I would actually go to school for about an hour or two in high school, and then I would leave and work full time. So I was able to, at a young age, I think I was 15 when I started in medical offices, learning the whole medical industry. And as I came out to go to BYU, I was putting myself through school again in the medical offices, knew everything about how to run the offices from the finance side and the patient side. And when I was acquiring software for the companies I worked for, the doctors I worked for, I actually thought, oh, that would be an easy job to sell software to doctors. That would be great. And so I ended up deciding to go work for a company that was a reseller of a nationwide software. And within a month, I sold about $30,000 of software for them. And I thought, why am I doing this for them? I should become the reseller. So I decided to raise $23,000 is what I started my first business with from my dad and my uncle and a brother, and raised the money from them and bought the rights to be a licensed reseller for, at the time it was HBOC, later it became McKesson. Mm-hmm. And so I was actually just going to work from home, and I would go and sell doctors from my home their software and get them trained and set up. But I was selling so much so quickly, I think I had 35 employees within a few months.
How old were you at the time?
Probably only 23.
Yeah.
And I had two little kids. At the time, I had a brand new baby and a three-year-old son. And so it was really because I wanted to be home with my kids was my motivation at the time. But I didn't expect it to take off like it did. I think I sold close to $2 million my first year in business, and it just continued to grow from there. So I basically bootstrapped after that first $23,000, the first business. And about 2 or 3 years into it, there was a merger between McKesson and HBOC that went bad. The two companies merged. There was a big scandal around HBOC stating their financials wrong, and it became a big lawsuit. And so I was worried that that would impact my ability to sell their software. You know, is it going to get the attention and so forth? And I had at the time negotiated to take over developing the software for HBOC. They really weren't putting a lot of money into furthering this product that I was selling. It was a Windows-based product. They could do a lot more with it than they were. So I had gone to the CEO and negotiated with him to take over the development on it for them. They would still own the source code. We would develop the software, and they would just pay us $2 million a year in development money, which we were really excited because we thought this is the whole purpose for us was we wanted to further sales. Mm-hmm. We thought if we can control the features and the benefits of the product, then we'll get more sales. So that's all I cared about. It wasn't really that I wanted to develop software, so to speak. But when that merger happened and the FBI came in and indicted the CEO, the CFO, I was actually supposed to sign a contract with them that very next day. And before I flew out, I found out they had actually been indicted and we couldn't do anything. So I had the question of whether I went and found another product to sell, which I really wasn't a fan of the other products out there, or I could actually do my own. And I'd never developed software. I knew software, but I didn't know how to create software. Does that make sense? I knew how to use the products. But I knew what the users needed. And so I actually made the decision to go ahead and do it ourselves. I thought, you know what, the internet is a really great tool because if we can develop a web-based product, nobody was doing that at the time. And yeah, the internet was like hot sizzle for advertising and things, but no one was really using it for product ASP offerings at the time. That was really kind of just barely being talked about.
Sure.
So
This was late 90s.
Yeah. And I thought, you know what, if I can do this in a web-based model, I can deploy this product all over the country, but only service it from here. It'll be, you know, I could stay here at home. And so we actually went out and raised venture capital, had no clue what I was doing at the time, but I raised my first $2 million and then later went on to do another round of about 10 or 11 million. And we developed the first web-based system in the country for medical offices. So it was funny because I never had the training or the background other than just the life experience of being around medical. And then I read a lot and was willing to dig in and I've always kind of figured it out by the seat of my pants, I guess, in a way. So
we'll get back to that, your entrepreneurial expertise here in a moment. But tell us, just also give us a little bit of an explanation of the, you know, the MediConnect story and the Globarian and sort of the evolutions there.
So after I was out of that first business, I had become friends with a lot of people from India. At the time, one of the companies that wanted to acquire my first company was a group called Healthion, which later was acquired by WebMD. And Healthion was about 500 guys from India in a Silicon Valley office, you know, doing medical-based connectivity portals. And I just made friends with a lot of the Indians and ended up making a lot of contacts within the country of India. And so I ended up meeting a partner, and we ended up starting a company there called Globarian, which did offshore outsourcing for healthcare companies. We did a lot of medical coding, medical billing, medical work. In the process of running that and having a blast kind of growing that business, Vspring Capital actually approached me about a business they had that they had invested in here that did medical record retrieval called MediConnect. And MediConnect was retrieving and digitizing medical records for the insurance market. But the company was losing about $180,000 a month. They had great technology, but they couldn't sell. So they asked me if I would step in and see what I could do with it. And at the time, I kind of hesitated because I already had this other project going. But I thought, okay, I'll give you 1 year. And it was agreed up front. 1 year, I'll get in, turn it around, sell it for you, whatever, and I'll get out. But I came in and immediately could see that it was a great technology and a great market. You know, I could obviously outsource it to my India business because they had a lot of call center work being done in the healthcare industry. So I did that and noticed that this company was focusing on the insurance market when the legal market was just this wide open market. So we kind of took the sales in a new direction and it turned around so fast. I mean, within 9 months, we were net positive and just growing like crazy. So in June of this year, I approached the investors behind MediConnect, and we sold both Globarian and MediConnect to merge them together basically into a new entity called MediConnect Global, and brought the two companies together because it was getting too hard to try to run two companies at once. And then we acquired our biggest competitor called Xerop in the legal industry and merged all three companies together. So now MediConnect Global we're about 12 to 1300 employees worldwide. We have two offices in India and two here in Utah. And we're now getting ready to open in either the Dominican Republic or in Africa, another outsourcing center.
It's an amazing story. It's a great company. It's tracking so well. You know, Amy, as I listen to your background and your experiences, I just really realized that your entrepreneurial flair has really seen you through to success, it feels like to me. And so I guess, there's so many questions often people ask, you know, what makes a great or a successful entrepreneur? I would pose that question to you. What does make a great entrepreneur?
I think it's a mix of different qualities. I mean, I definitely think to be a good entrepreneur, you gotta have a passion. And you can have a passion for a lot of things. I think a lot of people have a misconception of what entrepreneurship really means, or what, you know, a lot of people think it's about control or about being able to be the boss of yourself and have free time and make a ton of money. And, you know, some of that stuff does happen, but I think it's not exactly like that. And as you talk to people that have been entrepreneurs, I think some people have a personality, there's, you know, they call it that undescribable factor. There's something that makes them, it's a wow factor.
I call it the X factor.
Yeah, I call it the wow factor. Yeah. And it's like, it's someone that really, I think you have to be a tremendous salesperson. If I'm honest about it, I think you can start a business, but to be the CEO and drive the business, you have to know how to sell all day long. Everything is about sales. I think you have to have a passion to want to, almost like you're not necessarily motivated by what someone else is going to say, good job. You have to be motivated by looking yourself in the mirror and going, I just did great. Yeah. I think you have to be very much able to be pleased with yourself, because there's not a lot initially when you're an entrepreneur, a lot of people going, good job, you know, later it comes. But by then you don't need it as much. You kind of figured it out by then. So I think that the ability to influence people, the ability to lead people and influence them to want to follow you and to get on board, I think is huge.
Which is an important part of the sales process as well.
So absolutely.
It's influencing both internally and externally in the organization.
Absolutely. And those are the things I think that, you know, it's a hard, hard career. Anyone that thinks it's not, I think, is probably in for a rude awakening. It's hard, but it is rewarding because you have the ability to create something and drive something in a direction that you decide, and hopefully you're right. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're wrong, but hopefully you're right. And I think for me, the coolest part about it is that you get to create an atmosphere where other people can succeed, that you get to help them succeed. You know, not everyone can put someone in a place to succeed. And as an entrepreneur, you get that chance.
I like that you talked about sales. I've always felt like, especially the business schools, maybe don't emphasize sales enough. And it feels like to me that all things being equal, if I could get somebody with, you know, with any business discipline, I'd probably pick sales first, assuming that they're somewhat resourceful as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because I spoke at they had a conference in Salt Lake here for the University Venture Fund. And they asked me, you know, what is it? How do we know if we're going to be a good entrepreneur? I said, if you can't sell something, and if you're too shy to get up and really just explain to someone why or what, you probably shouldn't be the CEO of a company. You might make a great COO or a great CFO or a great business development person, but sales, if you want to be the leader, you got to be able to sell, and you got to be able to excite people and create an energy and a passion there, because, you know, it's not fun to work. Yeah. You know, let's be honest, it's really not fun to work. And so you have to make it where people feel like it's fun to work if you want to get the most out of them.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Amy, you've had an opportunity to work with a variety of different venture capitalists and investors. I think that's also something that you've been able to see and experience that not a lot of people here in the state or in the region have had an opportunity to be exposed to. When and how are venture capitalists useful? Should an entrepreneur always seek venture financing? Give us some of your thoughts on working with venture capitalists.
That's a great question. I think, you know, when I teach at the colleges, the kids all ask, you know, should we raise VC money or would you stay away from it? And I've heard professors say, don't ever raise it. Or, you know, venture capital is a really tremendous thing and it has a place. You just have to know and understand what is the price you pay to take venture money. So there's the pluses and the minuses, right? The plus side is it can launch you faster. If you can raise VC funding and get yourself a salary, a lot of the people that are trying to bootstrap a company don't have the ability to work without making some money. So if you get VC backing, you're instantly getting paid. Yeah. The trade-off is that you may instantly get paid, but you now work for somebody. I don't care what anybody tells you. If you take VC money, if you take any money, it doesn't matter if it's the VC, the bank, whoever, you work for somebody. And people that want to be an entrepreneur to not work for somebody just completely went against their whole rationale for doing it, right?
For being an entrepreneur to begin with.
Yeah. If that was their whole reason for wanting to be an entrepreneur.
And it typically
a lot of people it is. Yeah. And so what I explain to people is, look, it's got a place and it can be extremely valuable. I think there's a misconception that you should just take whatever money a VC will throw at you. I think that's a huge mistake. Money is far more accessible than people realize. You want to take smart money, money that comes with influence, money that comes with connections, money that comes with a knowledge of your industry or the players in the industry. So I think entrepreneurs that go to raise VC money need to really take a hard look at what, besides the cash in my bank account, can this venture capital group do for me?
Is that difficult to find, that kind of compatibility?
I think the problem is the entrepreneurs don't think about it. Yeah. So they go in and they're just so desperate for money. They feel like beggars can't be choosers, which is kind of a misconception in their own head, but it comes from insecurity. They don't know, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that they think, I have to take it from where I get it. I think if they were smart, they would look at and ask the VC, what else do you bring to the table? Because I think the VCs are very impressed by an entrepreneur who wants to see what connections they hold. And a lot of your exit and the value on an exit is going to come from who that VC knew, because especially as a first-time entrepreneur, you don't know people to go to.
I know that VSpring looks for mutual compatibility.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we're heavily aligned on a lot of objectives. So.
Well, you take someone like let's say you're going to start a pharmaceutical type company, right? You go get a Dinesh Patel to be on your board who has more ties into that field than anybody. You're not just getting money. Now you're getting influence. You're getting potential buyers. You're getting partners. I mean, it really, you can get a lot more to the table. So I think taking VC money is smart if you have the desire to work for somebody and to have them help you succeed. If you want to do it on your own, you shouldn't take VC money. You just should never take it. If you really, really want to be your own boss and be beholden to no one, then bootstrap it or you know, do bank debt where they're not going to really care about the personal side of the business. But I actually think I think VC money is a great tool for the entrepreneurs that are realistic, that understand what they're doing and what the ramifications could be if they don't do well. I think then it can be a really good tool. But I do think there needs to be more education in the universities for entrepreneurship about what VCs expect and what will happen or if you don't live up to those expectations.
What the trade-offs are. It is a strategic decision for the company and for yourself as the entrepreneur as well. Yeah. So, Amy, if you could pick any mentor to you know, spend time with, a business mentor, who would you pick?
You know what? That's a great question. My answer would probably surprise you. I think that I would look to who I think is a great leader. You know, locally here, I would probably spend time with Gordon B. Hinckley, the president of the LDS Church, because he and my grandfather were actually business partners for about 50 years. Mm. And I've heard my grandpa talk about the stories about leadership. And so for me, it's someone, I look at him as a man who's got influence over people all over the world, no matter what their religious beliefs are. And I look at his sense of humor and the way he looks at life and just happy and positive. He is someone who I have a tremendous, I would love to learn from him in business, actually. Yeah. Another great person is actually someone that I am partnered with, which is Dr. Naresh Trahan. The man has an amazing ability to influence and lead people, and it's because he genuinely cares for people. So I look at those two men, totally different backgrounds, different religions, different histories, and yet they both have this massive influence over the people in their lives because they care about the people they work with. So yeah. I would spend time with those types of people, I think. One other mentor that I think that I actually do already get to work with, who's I feel really, really lucky to be able to have him as a mentor in my life, is James Sorensen Jr. I also work with James LaVoy, but Jim Jr. and I've been able to have him on my board of directors as a personal investor in the company. And to work with someone who is so tremendously strong at business, who gets the numbers, who understands the strategy, and who's such a quick mind, has been for me just absolutely an amazing learning experience. But to watch him be so financially successful, you know, here's a man who's worth more than most people will ever be worth, and yet he treats everybody around him just with class and with dignity. He's just an amazing guy that way. So I probably have been blessed to have some of the best mentors a girl can have, for sure, in business, or anyone for that matter.
Final question, Amy Lewis. If you could do anything other than what you're doing right now, that you would focus your time and energies on, what would that be?
I love humanitarian work. I love the charity work. I've been really, really blessed to be able to do a lot of the charity work in countries like India. And just I think the greatest thing is if you can mix business and, you know, the ability to make money, doing something that also helps people. So finding businesses that you can be part of, or charities you can be part of, where if you need to generate revenue, great, but it can also be doing something good for people that it services. I think that's like the ideal type of situation. And so I actually love, like, Unitas is a great charity that does the micro lending into countries like India and Africa and South America. And it's it's all about helping these women who are, a lot of them, single mothers and in poverty, help them start companies and grow businesses and get their family out of poverty. And I guess now, I've been divorced 7 years of being a single mom, I have a lot of empathy for the women who have to raise their own family and work and figure it all out. And so those types of charities, that for me is just, I love it. It's the happiest thing I do today. So,
Amy Lewis, thank you for being here today. This is the V100 Show. My name is Dennis Wood.
This has been a Rocky Mountain Voices podcast. Visit us on the internet at www.rockymountainvoices.com.